Welcome to the Tradies in Business podcast with your hosts, Warwick Bidwell and Nicole Cox. Divert your phone and grab a brew as Waz and Nick unpack tips, tales, secrets and stuff-ups from guests both inside and outside your trade, helping educate and inspire you to break the cycle of gut-busting and money stress and create a true trade business.
G'day listeners, Waz here coming at you. Welcome to another episode of the Tradies in Business podcast. Now, I'm flying solo for the intro. I think Coxie's brain got a bit overheated after today's episode talking about the BIF Act, B-I-F. And if you don't know what the BIF Act is, as the title of this episode suggests, you really need to go and figure it out. It's incredibly important if you are doing any work in the building and construction industries. If you're a subbie, if you're a builder, if you're working for a primary contractor, then this has some pretty serious implications for you, and it can actually make a big difference to your business. So we actually interviewed a lawyer today who specializes in construction law and actually sat on a government review panel, I think. Sorry to Fiona, today's guest, if I got that wrong, but was definitely involved in the consultation process around having a look at the legislation and how it would play out for you, for tradies. So have a listen to today. It's definitely worth your time and exposing your ears to some legal stuff. It can get a little confusing, but basically, if you listen all the way to the end, it'll make a lot more sense. I was going to take the opportunity to hang a bit of crap on Coxie, given that she's not here for this intro. And Coxie, you're safe. I thought I'd do the right thing. I'd be a noble co-host, and I wouldn't tell people some of the deep dark secrets of what goes on here in the studio. So enjoy today's episode. Now, listen to the end because Fiona from Aitchison Reed does actually make a special offer just for listeners. So they have some courses to help you get your head around the whole BIF Act thing. So if you listen to the end, you'll get the details for that. And as always, we love hearing from you. So go hit us up in the group, Tradies in Business, on Facebook, or go to the website, tradiesinbusiness.com.au. There's a cool little voice recorder thingy on the homepage. I'm dying for someone to send us a question via that. So go and if you want to get your voice on the podcast, if you want to be semi-famous like Ed Ray from McKellar Electrical talking to us about his Sydney to Hobart race, how cool was that? That was a cracking episode. Such an amazing story. I just love it when people share honestly with us. So if you want to be like Ed, you don't have to have a whole episode, but we'll play your little voice note. Go to the homepage on the website, tradiesinbusiness.com.au, and record us a little voice message question, or just send us a g'day, and tell us who you are, and we'll play it on the next episode. So anyway, strap yourself in for some legal stuff today. Find out what on earth is the BIF Act. All right, so Fiona from Aitchison Reed, welcome to the Tradies in Business podcast. Great to have you with us today.
Welcome, Fiona.
Thank you, and it's great to be here.
Now, we've just literally finished discussing my distaste for bio reading and introducing guests in a way that is boring as a proverbial. Fiona, can you give our listeners a bit of an idea of, you know, did you just like wake up one day as a 10-year-old girl and decide you wanted to be a lawyer, or was there a bit of a journey involved in getting to this stage?
Yes. Well, it's a very long story actually. So I'll try and keep it as quick and as interesting as possible. So when I left school, I didn't quite know what I wanted to do. I think I was probably like everybody else. I had no idea what I wanted to do, and I'm a bit of a nerd, and I'm completely open about it. I'm a complete nerd. I absolutely love science, and I loved English and also art. So I had, I kind of like, I could roundabout do what I wanted to do. So I tried to find as many things I could do at the same time at university. So I could fit in architecture and law together. I also tried to get in engineering and design, but I couldn't fit those in. So I did architecture, intermediate, and first year law in my first year at university. And I thought, you know, how will I know what an architect does? Because I've never, you know, you don't do architecture at school. And my school was a very small girls' school, so we didn't even have tech drawing. So I didn't even know how to draw on the drawing board. And then I thought, well, I don't even know what law is really like. I mean, I've done English, that's not very helpful. So I thought, okay, well, what if I do both and one will pick me? And I got to the end of first year and I had got into law school for second year and I'd also got into architecture and I was like, oh, what do I do? And then I thought, what if I combined it? What if I did law and building science? And so I went to the, you know, the careers person at the architecture school and she said, you know, that's the first time that they've had someone come and want to do it. And there was actually two of us. So there is a bit of a story behind that is I'm hideously competitive, especially if there's a boy involved. So the other person who wanted to do building science and law, it was the first time anyone was doing it. There were two of us and one was a boy. And he happened to be like, you know, a rugby player and, you know, one of the lads.
Yep.
That was it. That was the writing on the wall. I did everything I could to be the first person. So I did summer school. I did twice as many credits, you know, more credits than I was supposed to be doing just to make sure. And I actually probably beat him by about a year. But
well done.
But nice,
that's kind of the backstory. But what it meant was that I could bring in my love of art with architecture and design, and I could bring in my science, my love of science, but also bring in the legal side. And what I found out is because I thought, you know, I'd be, what will I be? I still kind of was tossing out. And I just loved law, to be honest. It was really my home, I found out. Because especially the type of law that a construction lawyer does, because it's very, it's quite rigid. It's a bit like science. You know, you go through a problem-solving exercise. So I would have to say that construction lawyers are a bit like tax lawyers in a way that we have to be very particular. We have to be, and that kind of suits my science background. So, and it's a beautiful way because every trade is really carrying out science experiments every day. I mean, that's what they're doing.
And not just with their lunch.
No. It's, you know, when we get into, you know, a dispute or something and I'm talking to a subcontractor, I have to know their trade and I have to know it fast because I've got to understand their trade and be able to explain it in plain English to somebody who might not be. So we often don't know with an adjudicator whether they've got a construction background or not. We don't know if they're a lawyer. We don't know if they're a quantity for that. So our role is very much to make it into plain English. So I see myself often as like a storyteller or a translator, being able to translate everything into plain English because I actually have no idea what my decision maker, what background they have. So I have to make sure they understand it.
It's cool. A really interesting way to frame out what it is that you do.
Yeah, because I guess it's you've already spoken to it a little bit, Fiona, but when I hear about construction law, I actually think, well, what is that? Like, what does it mean to be a construction lawyer or, you know, to specialize in building and construction law? And I suspect a lot of people listening would have the same lack of clarity about what's involved in that field. So, like, why would someone go and see a construction lawyer?
Okay, so a construction, it's a beautiful question because it's a question I get asked all the time. In fact, loads of people say to me, I didn't even know that existed. And there are a whole pile of us. So what construction law is, it is the law relating to construction on site. So it is, we go and look at all the contracts that are involved in construction. So we're looking at, firstly, the contract between the developer and the head contractor, and then the head contractor with all the subcontractors. And of course, then you have sub-subcontractors. So that's in a commercial or even a residential build, you would have that with the homeowner. So we look at all those different contracts, and with that, there's two parts to it, we call it, and it sounds a bit rude. It's the front end and the back end. Mm-hmm. So the front end is the contract drafting, and it's the pre-contract advice. And to be honest, that's the space I like to be in most, because we're being proactive, we're saving people money, and we can make a real difference there. And I learned this very early on in starting my own practice, often people don't come to you unless they have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't think about all the problems they could have until they have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why, despite not really wanting the practice originally to be doing disputes, we do disputes, and we do a lot of them. So as you can imagine, each connection, each transaction you have, whether it's from the principal to the head contractor or the head contractor down to a subbie, each one has the potential for something to go wrong, whether it's a payment issue or it's to do with the materials that they're using, or it could be just something environmental like a latent condition. You know, you could have terrible weather and issues be caused on site. So it's all of those things, but it's also the connection that with. So if we looked at the acts that I deal with, I also deal with the QBCCA, so that's the Queensland Building and Construction Commission Act. And what that has is a whole pile of things about licensing as well. So we do deal with licensing, and we have helped people get their licenses back as well. And of course now the other acts are far more regulated, so we're involved with that too.
Yeah, right. I guess it's human nature that we disagree about things. And, you know, when you start looking at businesses and contracts and that sort of stuff, I do wonder sometimes, it's like, how come there are so many disputes? You know, like you look at the number of just commercial lawyers, not even specializing in construction, to see that there must be a lot of people arguing about a lot of things. And I guess I think about building and construction law, and I think, what are people disagreeing about? You know, isn't it in the contract? So yeah. What are some of the most common arguments that people have, Fiona?
Often it is that they don't know what's in their contract. That can often be an issue. There was an old culture of sign the contract and put it in the bottom drawer and never see it again. And that's kind of because I'm so old. when I started in construction, which is in 2002, that culture was ending when I started. So that was the culture that, you know, I got to meet those guys who did everything on a handshake, and things just got built that way. And they were beautiful. They were just beautiful guys. Unfortunately, what was coming through at the same time was a wave of people who are a bit slicker, who wanted to rely on the contract that they knew the other guys wouldn't read, and they tied them up in knots. So a lot of it is about, I would say part of it is about miscommunication, and that's the reason for people not understanding with disputes or misunderstanding their contractual obligations. Or you can often, and you can have this with two lawyers, we can have one clause and one will swear black and blue it says one thing, and one will swear it says something else. So I think often people interpret different things different ways. The disputes I think that are the worst are when it's friends and family.
Yes.
And those are the worst because, you know, you have a mate and they say, oh, can you do this for me? And go, oh, yeah. But you don't actually communicate properly. You don't communicate how you normally would with someone you were going to contract with. And what normally happens is you don't have anything in writing, or if you do, it has nothing to do with what you actually agreed. And then it goes pear-shaped because both parties have completely different ideas about what you agreed to. So that would be my big thing for your listeners, doing anything for friends and family. Actually try and be even more careful with your paperwork because at the end of the day, you don't want those relationships to fall apart.
No.
Just because you have a misunderstanding. So a lot of it is to do with misunderstandings. Unfortunately, the construction industry has had some really unscrupulous players especially in the commercial space.
Mm-hmm.
And that has caused a lot of pain for subbies, and that's partially why we say we're subby lawyers. We don't play in the builder space so much. It's not that we don't think there are great builders out there. There's some beautiful builders out there who pay their subbies on time, who just do what they say they're going to do. And basically, those are the builders I wish every subcontractor could work for.
Yeah.
But that doesn't happen all the time. And there are games that are played. You know, people make mistakes, and rather than taking responsibility for their mistakes, they pass those mistakes down to the subcontractors.
Mm.
And that's where it really hurts, because, you know, it's small families who don't have the ability to deal with, or the financial means to deal with, the risks that they have.
Mm. How much ownership do you think subbies need to take for playing in that space in the first place?
Now, this is probably something that you're actually on a very good point. As much as I advocate for subcontractors, and I believe that subcontractors have had a rough deal, I also truly believe that subcontractors have a responsibility to read their contracts and to actually know how to enforce payment. I have been known in some of the subby groups to say things like, "But this act, which is our new piece of legislation, is not fairy dust. It is not going to sprinkle payment on all subcontractors.
No.
They actually need to know how the act works and what how you enforce it. Because there are very strict timeframes, even though they've been extended, and the timeframes are much better than they used to be. But we're talking about, you know, 4 weeks, 6 weeks at the maximum, that they need to take action. Now, frequently, we'll have subcontractors come to us with a six-month-old debt. And we're going, well, by now, our hands are very much tied. We had so many things we could do for you if you'd come to us within a couple of weeks. There was, you know, we have so many avenues. You could be looking at suspending works if it's a debt due. We could be enforcing it, an adjudication with a quick-fire adjudication. Have a, you know, almost have a judgment debt within, say, 6-7 weeks. But we can't do that 6 months down the track. We're stuck with the, you know, the old way that everyone else actually has to deal with in the commercial world, which is going to court, going and filing a statement of claim and a claim with, say, the Mags Court, and then waiting for the other side, because of course they're going to bring up a dispute, waiting for them to bring up a dispute, and, well, lo and behold, we're in court for years.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the whole purpose of security payment, was to avoid that. But you're absolutely right that subcontractors actually need to take action early. Otherwise, all of these beautiful, and I like to call them power tools, all these beautiful power tools, they can't use them.
Yep.
They're just not available to them.
Yep. And it's, sorry, Nicole and I were just recording some video before we did our interview, Fiona, for the trade desk, where we were talking about, you know, what to do when you can't pay your own bills. And one of the things that people do, sadly, is stick their head in the sand and leave it go for so long, and it actually gets worse. And I suppose it's related to this same issue, where if you're not getting paid by, you know, the contractor, by the builder, you do need to take ownership of that and do something proactive about it, rather than just kind of let it drag out, because often you can miss out on the opportunity to do something about it, particularly now with the new BIF Act.
Definitely. Actually, I've got something really, I suppose, really important for your listeners to hear about debts that they owe, which is that under the BIF Act, now if you're purchasing materials or related construction goods, or you're purchasing construction work, so your subcontractors, or your or related services, which could be hiring equipment, or having a design, say you do landscaping and you get a landscape designer. If you receive an invoice, that could be a payment claim now under the BIF Act, because they don't need to say this is a payment claim anymore. So if you're receiving an invoice, it could be a payment claim. And if it's a payment claim and you don't pay by the due date, and you don't send a payment schedule within 15 business days, there are two things you are now responsible for. One, you are liable for the entire amount of that debt. And two, you can be fined by QBCC. Just for not sending that payment schedule.
So I actually think this whole act is really confusing for subcontractors. I feel that it's an area that we've all looked at some of the education, and I'm going to say that quite loosely because that education really wasn't targeted for the most part, I think, in a way that most tradies are going to be able to relate to. And I feel that some, you know, it's a question that we're asked so frequently. Many tradies don't understand the BIF Act and how they can use the BIF Act to their advantage. Is that something that you could briefly talk us through, Fiona?
Oh, definitely, definitely. I completely agree. I feel that, and for those of your listeners listening, I was actually involved in the government's evaluation panel of the BIF Act. So I was part of the four people that were appointed by the minister to look at the BIF Act. And as part of that, we got to go around the state talking to people and finding out what they know. And I would definitely say there is a massive part of our construction community that does not understand the BIF Act. And it's really concerning because there's two parts to it. As a trade, so if you are a subcontractor, you would have normally always thought of yourself as a claimant. And so I always say, so you had your claimant hat on and you were always a claimant. And so you always thought security payment was about you. It's all about you getting paid. However, it's now also that subcontractor can be a payer. So I always say they've got their payment payer hat on. And that means they don't just need to know their obligations as a claimant, they need to know it as a payer as well. And that causes a lot of confusion for subcontractors because a lot of them never use security of payment because they're like, oh, but I've got these great relationships, so I don't want to rely on it. Now, under the BIF Act, it's pretty much made mandatory. So not only do you need to know about it, it's mandatory, so it's happening anyway. And on top of that, you're going to be a payer as well. So yes, there is a lot more that everyone needs to know. And if you go back to my analogy of it being like a power tool, so you've got this power tool, and it's fantastic. So you can think of like the best chainsaw you've ever imagined. It's just fantastic, and they've just upgraded your chainsaw. And on top of that, you need to know how everyone knows that if their chainsaw has been upgraded, they need to know how it works and how to, you know, have their PPE on and have all their safety equipment. They need to know how it works and to keep themselves safe. This is exactly the same as the BIF Act, apart from one thing. Now that it's mandatory, it's like your chainsaw is on and there's no off button. So it's kind of like you, if you don't have your PPE on, you're going to get hurt. So it's really important to make sure that you understand how this act works. So we do have an online course that can help all of your listeners with it. And in that, I go over everything for a person who has never done security payment before and doesn't understand. So I take them through every step. But to give you a bit of an understanding really quickly, security of payment is all about encouraging communication between the parties. So with your claim or your invoice, it's supposed to have information on it so that the person paying you understands what they're paying for. And if the other side has a dispute, they send a payment schedule, and that is supposed to say not only how much they intend to pay you, but also identify your invoice and also say the reasons why they refuse to pay you. Now, that's all about encouraging communication, and I think we could probably agree that construction industry as a whole is not great at communicating. And this would kind of just force them through this whole communication thing, so that they would be able to, people would understand what was going on, because if you understand the basis of a dispute, often that's all you need to sort it out. The next part about it is then giving consequences. So I said one before, that if you don't give a payment schedule now, if you don't tell your reasons, you don't pay, there's a consequence, there's a QBCC fine, and you're liable for that whole amount. The other consequences are the enforcement rights that a claimant has. So they are, if you've got a debt due, you can suspend, you can give a notice to suspend works. If you've got a debt due, you can go to court, but you have to give a warning notice first within 20 business days. Or you can go to adjudication within 30 business days. So you can see the time frame, how quick they are, 20 business days, 30 business days. If you've got a dispute, so say that payment schedule says a whole pile of reasons why they don't want to pay you, then you go off to adjudication, and that's an extremely fast and efficient way of getting a dispute resolved. Do you imagine, you know, before I said, you know, you're looking at a couple of years in court to get a dispute sorted out, yeah. And that's if you're lucky. With adjudication, you're looking at about 6 weeks unless the adjudicator requests further time. So that's for a standard payment claim as well. Complex payment claims, which are over $750,000, they can be a bit longer. Mm. But if we're just talking about standard payment claims, you're talking about 6 weeks. That's insanely fast.
It's not long. I know people that don't even put invoices in inside of 6 weeks.
Yeah, yeah. So it's fast track, and the whole idea is about getting cash flow, because I imagine you guys are talking to your tradies about cash flow all the time. Cash flow is king. Yep. So this is completely reflecting that saying, cash flow is king. Let's get the cash down. Let's get it down as quickly as we can, because we don't want to starve the people at the bottom of cash flow. Because originally the way that these projects used to happen is that that's exactly what happened. They got starved. Yeah. We had paid when paid. So that's another issue that a lot of people still don't seem to understand. Paid when paid is illegal. Mm. So you cannot say to someone, I'm not going to pay you because I haven't been paid.
Yes.
It's not a reason to do it. Legally or morally, no. Even, you know, it's not my fault that exactly. You can't run your cash flow properly.
Exactly. So if somebody hasn't paid you, you're still responsible to pay the person down the line.
Mm-hmm.
And I have heard this from builders and from subcontractors. So everyone is guilty of saying this at times to those people who they pay. So
yeah. Yep.
It's really important that they understand that.
Yeah.
I'm just, in listening to you, Fiona, I'm wondering, is this a process that a subcontractor can do themselves, or do they need to have a lawyer involved in the process if they have a dispute, or if they need to go and to the adjudicator? Do they have to have someone involved, or is this designed in a way that a subcontractor can actually take care of it themselves?
So if we just look at adjudication, which is, I think, what you're talking about, mm-hmm. the dispute. Adjudication is designed for subcontractors to do themselves.
Mm-hmm.
However, we have found, and there are QBCC statistics on this, that there have been a lot of adjudication applications that have failed going into the registry, and that's often from subcontractors or claimants putting in applications and not quite understanding the law,
mm-hmm.
not quite doing their applications well enough that they are successful. So what we've actually put together as a practice is a kit or a pack of four adjudications. So basically they get all the templates from us in an hour of our time to check everything. And the reason for being that is because a lot of the adjudications are under $25,000.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just not economic for them to get legal advice.
Mm.
So we tried to think of a way that we could make it still kind of lead everyone onto the right track, but they didn't have to pay legal fees for it. So that's, yeah. And I think it's about $1,400, $1,500 for that pack, including an hour of our time. And it's a pack that can be used over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a way that people can still do adjudication and still have kind of have some feeling like they know what they're doing.
Sure.
I like to say it's adjudication paint by numbers.
My paint by numbers were awful when I was a kid.
I'm not surprised. Fiona, can I throw a bit of a hypothetical at you? Sorry, Woz, for cutting you off.
No, it's okay. You do it all the time.
I know. Yeah. No, actually, I don't.
No, I cut you off.
Yes, all the time.
You wanted to say something, Nicole? Sorry, Fiona, we're just doing a slapstick routine here. We're making law fun.
Yes. I'm just thinking about somebody I was speaking to recently, and this person is a subcontractor. They're a carpentry subcontractor, and they're working with – it's a very complex situation, so I'm just going to do a smoother, more hypothetical situation. They're working with a builder, and there was a workplace health and safety audit done on the site, and the subcontractor decided he no longer felt safe working for that builder and wouldn't return to site. So the builder terminated their, I guess, terms of employment or contract. I don't think the contract was very strong. Where I'm leading to here is he's then sent an invoice, a final invoice, to the builder, who has for the last month refused to pay. In that sort of situation, given that I haven't given you all of the details, what does the subcontractor do now? What's the first thing that they need to do to correctly enact the act?
Okay. So the very first thing that they need to do, and it's something I haven't talked to you about so far, is firstly they need to know their reference date. Now, mm-hmm. It sounds like a really benign kind of thing, but it's the date from which you're entitled to send your payment claim. So under the Act, if the contract has been terminated, you do get a reference date. So the next thing is, I've got my reference date. Okay, I can now send my payment claim.
Mm-hmm.
So the next thing would be to send a payment claim or an invoice, make sure it fulfills all the requirements, which are a request for payment, state the claimed amount, and also identify the construction work. So make sure all of those things are on it. Then serve it on the payer. Now, that could be often in the contract.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not in the contract, it's important to remember that sometimes in those cases, email is not a way that you can serve. So at the moment, we've got a bit of a hiatus. Currently, the Act says that email is only available if in the contract.
Okay.
If you have a kind of like a behaviour, you probably could argue it, but it's always better to just use post or the other methods. So you can use post, hand delivery, or fax, believe it or not, that's included. So you serve it on the other side, and then they have 15 business days to raise a dispute.
Mm-hmm.
And that's for the payment schedule. So you get your payment schedule back. And it sounds like more than likely this person will get a payment schedule back. And that will say, identify their payment claim. It will state how much they want to pay and also say the reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing about the reasons is if they go to adjudication, if your subbie decides to go to adjudication, they already know those are the only reasons that payer can bring up an adjudication.
Uh-huh.
So if their reasons are terrible, it's gold.
Yes.
Basically. So then if they do receive a payment schedule, it's 30 business days from receiving the payment schedule to go to adjudication and mm-hmm. make an application and file it with QBCC. If they don't get a payment schedule, it's 30 business days from the due date for payment.
Right.
So that there are time frames that they've got to do these applications in.
Mm-hmm.
The payer will have 10 business days to make a response.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, if they don't raise a payment schedule, they can't raise any issues
mm-hmm.
other than jurisdiction. There's something wrong with the payment claim.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they do send a payment schedule, they get to raise only those reasons raised in the payment schedule.
Mm-hmm.
Then the adjudicator has 10 business days to make a decision. Now, the adjudicator can ask for further information and also request further time, but generally 10 business days, that decision will be made. And then if it's not paid in 5 business days, you can enter it request a certificate, enter as a judgment, and also the payer gets a QBCC fine for not paying within 5 business days.
Mm-hmm. So in this case, who is the adjudicator?
So the adjudicator is someone who has been appointed by the QBCC Registry for Adjudications, and they are somebody who has 10 years experience in construction
mm-hmm.
and has also done an adjudication course.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not necessarily a lawyer or a judge or anything like that?
No, no. So there are lawyers who are adjudicators, but there are also quantity surveyors, engineers. It could just be people who have had building experience and have decided to become an adjudicator. So there's a raft of people, and what the registry tries to do is pick somebody who's got the right experience for your dispute.
Yeah, right. So, you know, I'm listening to all of this and thinking there's a lot of stuff that subbies and builders that we all need to, you know, educate ourselves on so that, you know, people don't fall foul of the law and end up in strife and getting fined simply because they didn't actually go find out about this stuff.
Definitely.
I suppose that the other thing that I'm thinking is I don't know that enough subbies are actually aware of all of this, and I suspect there might be some assumptions that this is like big end of town stuff and doesn't apply to a one-man band working for a builder or three. Is that something that you come across, Fiona?
Oh, definitely, definitely. I often get, when I say to subbies, because whenever I meet a subby, and it, literally we've been having work done to our building, so I literally introduce myself to everyone. And so, do you know about the BIF Act? I'm sorry to be a pain, but do you know about it? And they'll go, no. Or some of them have even said to me, oh, that doesn't apply to me.
Yes.
It's just about project bank accounts. Everyone thinks this is about project bank accounts.
Yes.
That's only about a quarter of the Act is about project bank accounts.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the really crucial part is really security of payment, because at the moment the project bank accounts only relates to government projects between 1 and 10 million, whereas security of payment doesn't affect all of the construction industry, pretty much. And because it's mandatory now, a lot of the people that would never have used it are now caught with it.
Yeah.
And as I said before, I mean, there is a bit of presumption as well that, you know, the government's come in, it's done its consultation, it's listened to subcontractors, everything's going to be okay. But, and, you know, if they actually know how to enforce their payments under the Act, they do have so much more power, but they do actually need to take some responsibility and go, I need to know about this. And they really, really do. As you can tell from some of the things that I'm saying, it's imperative that they all know what to do, because this is about saving their businesses.
Yeah.
It could be about also saving their families, because we all know that we're talking about small family businesses who, if they don't get paid, they really suffer.
Mm.
It is one of the big complaints, I guess, from the trades, particularly working for bigger contractors, bigger construction companies. I just want to clarify something. So, you know, I hear this story a bit, and I've heard it from friends of mine, sadly, where they, you know, they have an opportunity to do some work for a big business, a big construction company, and the terms that are being dictated to them for payment are way longer than what, you know, in my experience would be considered commercially sustainable or reasonable. You know, in some cases, 90 or 120 day payment terms. Is any of that dealt with in the Act, or is that just purely down to if you don't like the payment terms, then don't do work for that contractor?
Actually, it's not dealt with in BIF. It's dealt with in the Queensland Building and Construction Commission Act. And it states in the Act that payment terms must be 15 business days between a principal, no more than 15 business days between a principal and a builder, or, you know, the head contractor.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be a builder. Or 25 business days for a subcontract. Now, then what this says is it says, well, if your payment terms are longer than 25 business days or longer than 15 business days, longer than the ones in the QBCCA, those terms in your contract are actually void. And you have to rely on the default provisions, which are in this, which is 10 business days.
Hmm. I bet there's a lot of people that don't know that, including us.
There are a huge amount of people who don't know that.
because it's one of the biggest things that I've come across over the years is, and I'm not pointing the gun at big builders or big contractors, because as you've pointed out as well, Fiona, there's some fantastic companies out there that are doing the right thing, that are working with their subby trades. And I also hear some pretty horrendous standover tactics really being used by big companies where it's like, well, if you don't like it, we'll find someone else who will.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. And I suppose my answer to all of that is, well, if they're going to be like that, you don't want to work for them.
No, you don't want to, but in some cases, I think subbies feel like they don't have a choice. You know, if that's the only work they've got on their plate at the moment, they literally just swallow it. It's hard to run a business like that.
It is, it is. And then what happens is those same guys end up coming to me a month before the end of the project. They haven't been paid and that job ends up costing them money.
Yep.
And that's always my concern, is you've got to pick those jobs that you actually make money out of.
Yeah.
There's no point doing a job where it's going to cost you money.
It's just rubbing salt into the wound, you know, the payment terms are long and then you didn't manage your variations and everything and you end up working, actually paying the company to work for them and not get paid.
Exactly. Exactly. I actually wrote an article saying that, you know, it's basically burning your cash flow at both ends.
Yeah.
You're paying to work.
Yeah.
Because you're paying for those materials, you're paying for your subcontractors, and you're not getting paid.
Yes.
And that's just, it's just awful.
Mm.
So the moral of the story is, don't do that.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing is, if it starts to happen, if you start seeing it, you do something quickly.
Yes.
Mm. Mm.
You've got to do something quickly. And if you're on site, it's perfect. If you have not been paid, you haven't received the payment schedule, and you haven't been paid by the due date, you can suspend work. That is the biggest pain in the side of a head contractor that you have.
Mm.
It's quick, it's efficient, and it causes pain. In fact, you'll probably just send the notice and they will start doing something.
Because chances are, in a lot of these cases, I suspect the primaries will know more about the legal side. So, you know,
they'll know how to stretch it.
Well, they will, but I think, you know, as a subcontractor, if you then follow the same law and you educate yourself about the Act and what you can do, chances are the primary contractor is going to know that as well. So, as you said, Fiona, you know, if you send the claim, then they're gonna do something about it because they don't want you to walk off site. So.
Exactly, exactly. So it's really important to make sure they do it properly and follow the steps. But that's exactly right. But, and often what I say is, you know, people say, oh, gosh, I'll wreck the relationship if I do. I used to be, if I put this as a payment claim on my invoices, I'm going to wreck the relationship. It's all over.
Yep.
I was like, actually, no, they're going to think you're savvy and they're going to think you're onto it. That's actually not a bad thing. And then when I talk to my friends who are in big building companies, and they used to tell me, the funny thing is, if my boss sees a payment claim on an invoice, it gets paid first.
Yep.
So what just, you know, it's kind of like there's this myth in the subby world that it's going to wreck their relationship. Yeah. But the reality is they probably would have got paid first.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, so yes, I definitely think that it's important to stand up for your rights and be savvy. And, you know, some of these guys, I remember and you may remember, may not remember some, there was Matrix and Essex projects were head contractors that went under a couple of years ago. And I remember reading both of those subcontracts at one stage. And I, for one of them, I read the subcontract and went to the client, look, we just don't want to pay you. The way this contract is drafted, it's appalling. They're just not going to want to pay you at all. It's just revolting. I then knew another client was doing work for one of them, and I called them up and said, look, I've just got this feeling. I've read the subcontract. It's awful. I really am concerned you're doing work for this particular builder, so I just want you to keep your ear out. And they're like, oh, no, 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 it's all good, it's all good. 6 months later, they called me and said, we've just got notice they've liquidated. We've got six jobs on the go.
Yeah.
Is there much we can do? And I went, not really, not anymore.
Not now, yeah. Yep.
And that just goes back for me to the head in the sand. She'll be right. It'll be okay. And I think sometimes tradies just get so far down the track with that they almost feel like they can't get out of that cycle, or, you know, to change that is too hard. And like you say, you know, they're fearful of wrecking the relationship. It's like, well, would you rather risk damaging the relationship or risk your own house and your own family's well-being? Because someone fell over that will probably be okay in the long run, and it's the smaller guys that, you know, that's catastrophic for them to lose 10 grand, 50 grand, 100 grand. So,
yeah, look, I've seen those guys that, you know, I've had a couple of guys come to me trying to get their licenses back. So they've, you know, 5 years down the track, they're trying to get their licenses back. And what they've gone through, their stories are very similar in that they, you know, they were doing really well and then suddenly guys weren't paying them. Both of them went through the GFC, and so it happened for them both during the GFC. They're doing really well. They suddenly weren't getting paid. They were trying to pay everyone they could. They weren't paying themselves as well during that time. And then what happens, it all kind of snowballs. The company goes under. Then, of course, they had personal guarantees, so they go into bankruptcy. And what happens to those guys is that their marriages definitely crumble.
Mm-hmm.
Their marriages fall apart. They go into incredible depression, as anyone would in the same circumstances. And I would not want that on anyone.
No.
I really wouldn't. And I suppose that's my driving force, is I know what's at the bottom of the cliff.
Mm.
I've seen it. I've had to, you know, be there for those guys and try and help them get their licenses back. And it's almost impossible now to do that. I wouldn't want that on anyone. So these guys need to think that, yes, what's more important? You're right. What's more important? Being mates and trying to be easygoing in the relationship, or your family on the other hand, and letting your family down.
And they're not mutually exclusive. As you said before, you know, just to put payment claim on an invoice means it'll probably get paid and they're not going to think any worse of you. Matter of fact, it'll probably be the other way, which is often the case with so many of these things.
So just to modify that a bit, that was under the old legislation.
Sure.
So we don't need to put payment claim on the invoice anymore.
It's just an example of that, tightening up what you're doing is not necessarily going to destroy it.
Now it's about enforcement, because now you kind of get through the gate on getting your invoices being payment claims pretty much. So now it's about enforcement and also knowing which of the invoices that they've sent are actually payment claims, because I can guarantee most of you guys are probably sending a couple of invoices a month. You only get one payment claim per reference date. So it's important to identify the payment claim and be able to enforce it, and also make the most of it. So that's a lot about what we talk about the online course, is kind of making the most out of that one reference date and making it your gold.
Mm.
Your gold one, and all the other ones don't matter so much.
Yep.
Fiona, can you tell us a little bit about where our listeners can find your online course?
You'd love to. You have to ask the techie people.
I'm just trying to remember. Oh, this is where Riley's really helpful. He remembers all of these things.
That's why
we
I have
need a Riley.
That's why I have Nicole, because she knows all the important stuff. Yeah.
I've got nothing.
Well, we'll throw that up in the show notes anyway for this episode.
I think it's subbiesgetpaid.com.au.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the website. Sorry, I just had to remember what it was.
All good. So, as I said, we'll throw up the links in the show notes to that. I wanted to ask, I know there's been a bit of techie stuff today, and just to wrap up, I really wanted to ask my favourite question, which is, if you had 1,000 tradies or subcontractors in a room, what's one piece of advice you would desperately want to leave them with, Fiona?
Oh, I would desperately want them to understand the importance of the BIF Act, and that it's upon them to enforce. So they need to know they've got through the starting blocks. They now have payment claims out there. The Act has been triggered. They must understand that they've only got between 4 and 6 weeks to do something about it.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Otherwise, they lose their ability under the Act until the next payment claim, and they might not have another one.
Yeah, that's a good
one.
So
it's super important that they know that, because the other thing I probably haven't said is, although you only get one payment claim per reference date, your contract often will limit how many reference dates you get. So as soon as you finish work, that's it. That's the end. Your last one is when you finish, and that's it. You don't get any more reference dates. If you get contracts drafted by us, you get way more reference dates. but this is your normal standard ones that other people draft.
Yeah, sure. Well, that's that hasn't been I'm going to say it, Fiona. I'm going to be honest. It hasn't been as yawn-worthy as I think that the law could be. And in actual fact, the opposite to that, I know I've had a few insights today that it's just like, holy crap, I know there are people out there that don't educate themselves enough about this and that are running a whole bunch of risks that don't need to. So that's been awesome. Yeah. Thanks so much.
Oh, all good. Hey, look, thank you so much for asking me to come on to your tradies podcast. It's just been awesome. And it's been awesome that, you know, hopefully we spread the message that they need to find out about this Act.
That's what it's all about. Well, thank you for your time, Fiona. We'll let you go and read some more contracts. Sounds exciting.
Very cool, very cool. Oh, before I go, I just wanted to add that for all of your listeners, we've got 20% off our course for the next month from the time that this podcast has been published.
That's sure. Great.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thanks again for coming on the show, Fiona.
Thank you.
Thanks, Fiona.
Well, there you go. Lots of legal jargon, but I got a lot out of that. I thought Fiona did a great job of explaining the BIF Act and some of the things that you need to be aware of, and especially some of the timings. It happens a lot quicker than we might think. So you've got to be organized, more reasons to have your paperwork sorted and your invoices up to date and all of your systems in place. If you've got any challenges with getting those things in place, go hit the website, tradiesinbusiness.com.au. There's heaps of templates and scripts and stuff on there that you can get for free. You don't need to be a member of anything. You can just go to the website and steal it all. Or if you jump in the Tradies in Business group on Facebook, you will find almost 1,000 other Tradies in Business, as well as Coxie and myself, available to answer questions. So if you trip over any of this stuff, or you're looking for, you know, what someone else has done in their business that's worked, you can actually get some really cool help from our community of tradies, which is growing rapidly. We're about to crack the 1,000 member mark, which is really cool, especially for a free group, and all very helpful. There's been no trolls in there, which is awesome. So anyway, go to the website, tradiesinbusiness.com.au, grab some of the free templates, and make sure you find this episode there. And the links to Fiona's offer will be in the show notes. That's it from Woz flying solo on the top and tail. I'm still not going to hang any crap on Coxie. I hope the brownie points are stacking up. Whatever you're doing, have a fantastic day, and we'll speak to you soon.
You've been listening to the Tradies in Business podcast with Warwick Bidwell and Nicole Cox. Find out more about today's guest, tools for your trade business, and other cool stuff at tradiesinbusiness.com.au.